Robert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. I hope the week has started well for you. It has started in a big way in Washington, D.C., the very first time you have a major Stonewall Day anniversary commemoration at the White House. We're going to be talking a little bit about that today. That press conference and public event with President Barack Obama is just coming to a conclusion. Let me tell you what we're going to be talking about as our main focus today, and it's the issue of adultery. Now, as many of you are hearing that, you say, well, does that really require a lot of careful Christian thinking? Isn't that one of the top ten? I mean, when you think about the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not commit adultery, isn't that an open and shut case? Well, in terms of the morality of adultery, you bet it is. But in terms of our understanding of how so many of these things could have happened that have recently been on the headlines, whether it's the governor of South Carolina or a senator from Nevada or any number of persons, perhaps closer to you in your hometown, perhaps even in your home church, the issue of adultery is back front and center. And I want to tell you why we need to talk about it. Reason number one is because the world is talking about it. The culture around us is trying to decide if adultery is a big deal. And if you need any evidence for that, just consider Sunday's edition of the New York Times. A major article with a headline, Marriage Stands Up for Itself. The headline underneath the main head is, A Scandalous Affair Can Be a Bump on the Road. Now, I don't think so. But we're going to be talking about why, in this age of confusion, adultery seems like no big deal to many people. We're going to talk about why, for Christians, it's not even just about sexual morality, but it's about a whole lot more. One of the big issues, however, in this article that ought to be our focus of attention is the reason why, and one of the reasons given why, in fact, the number one reason given why persons have affairs, as in this New York Times article research is brought up, it says that it's availability or opportunity, which is another reminder to us that one of our Christian responsibilities is to deny ourselves the opportunity, not just the reality, but the opportunity. And we're going to be talking about that today on the Albert Mohler Program. Quite frankly, I cannot think of a more important issue for us to discuss today, because out there in the listening audience right now, there may be some persons listening to my voice right this very moment who are contemplating adultery. I want you to count the cost with me. I also want you to join the conversation. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to get to that topic in just a moment. In Washington, D.C., at the White House, President Barack Obama held a public event in which he welcomed persons from the gay rights community to talk about the anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion that took place in New York 40 years ago and his commitment to what he would term as civil rights for homosexual persons. Now, all over the newspapers just in the last several days, in anticipation of this anniversary, there has been a flurry of news activity. Tomorrow we'll be looking a little more closely at what the president had to say at this public event. But it is nonetheless a very clear indication of where we are as a culture that the event took place in the first place. Now, yesterday's edition of the New York Times was really filled with all kinds of material related to the 40th anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion, which is the date that many people would point to as when the gay rights movement began in America. On the front page of the New York Times yesterday was a political memo column written by Adam Nagorny, always a fascinating writer, keen political insight, and he argues that the political shifts on gay rights are really falling far behind the cultural shifts. Now, as you're listening to me today, I want to point to one particular cultural shift, which it really says everything, I think, in terms of how the future is taking shape. A New York Times CBS News poll last spring found that 57% of people under 40 said that they supported same-sex marriage, compared with 31% of respondents over age 40. Andrew Kohut, the president of the Pew Research Center, said the generational shift was reflected in his polling, in which the number of Americans opposing gay people serving openly in the military had dropped to 32% now from 45% in 1994. David Axelrod, who was the main political advisor to President Barack Obama, said, quote, "You look at polling and attitudes among younger people on these issues are startlingly different than older people." That's a sentence fragment, but you get the point. A stark difference. Now, I want you to consider that for a moment, because when you think about the future in terms of this culture, it turns out that the generational shift is pretty much pointing in a direction of increased normalization, if not total normalization, of homosexuality. Now, the problem, as I will point out repeatedly, is that no one even looks at what that would exactly look like when it takes shape. Because, after all, when you're talking about those who style themselves as sexual moralities, you're really talking about an ever-expanding list. Speaking of that ever-expanding list, the news has come out today that President Obama and his team in the White House are looking to frame policies that will add protections for transgender federal employees as well. Just another reminder that it's not just gay and lesbian anymore. It's gay, lesbian, transgender, transsexual, bisexual, and that list will get longer. Another very fascinating article that relates to this generational shift is found in New York Magazine over the weekend. And the title of this is The Gay Generation Gap, but it's not about how Americans are showing a generation gap in dealing with the issue of homosexuality. It's about the fact that within the homosexual movement and the homosexual community, there's a very clear generation gap as well. The generation gap goes back to those who are of the baby boomers in their 40s and 50s who were activists, and those who are now in their teens and 20s who seem not to be so committed to activism. Now, one of the most fascinating things about this is that this article, written by an older homosexual, says that the younger homosexuals are unconcerned about activism because they are absolutely convinced that the culture is going their way. In other words, they really do not see much panic, that they do not see much to grumble about. Instead, they say, you should simply understand the culture is going this way, so blend into the culture. Very, very interesting. This article in New York Magazine indicates that the generation gap among those in the homosexual community really comes down to whether you see things going in the right direction or not. One of the things, so let me just read this paragraph here. It says, without forgetting that for too many gay kids, coming out is still hell. This is an older homosexual writing this. We're also witnessing the rise of a parallel generation of gay kids with unflinchingly supportive parents, buddies who cheer their comings out on Facebook, high schools with gay-straight alliances, in other words, kids who have grown up in a world that's finally beginning in a few places to look like the one we wanted to create for them or for ourselves. Now, it's interesting, again, to look at the media and come to find that there's a generation gap even within the homosexual community, and the big gap is between those who think that activism is still the way forward and others who seem quite convinced, and the New York Times has given them reason to have confidence in that, that the culture is fundamentally moving in their direction anyway. We'll be looking at this issue again tomorrow. It's just a reminder to us that we are in the midst of a great cultural transformation going on all around us, and that cultural transformation right now seems on so many different issues to be focused on human sexuality. And the big question for the Christian church is how we keep our wits at this time, how we raise our children in the midst of this, and how we frame an appropriate response. That is no easy issue when you think about the complexities of this issue now in the opening decade of the 20th century. Speaking of how America is changing, there's a very interesting story out on a new mosque in Boston. And this particular mosque, by the way, is expected to house up to 3,000 congregants. That's 3,000. That's big news just about anywhere. But in a city like Boston, it tells you a very great deal that a new mosque could include as many as 3,000 persons at one time. The Boston Globe reports on this. And the opening paragraph says, at midday today, a local Muslim will clamber 185 feet up a ladder inside the narrow minaret atop the domed brick mosque and recite Islam's haunting call to prayer. The chant will mark the ceremonial opening of one of the most disputed projects in Boston's long history of prominent religious edifices. It is a $15.6 million mosque in Roxbury Crossing. Now, there are those in Boston who are accusing this mosque and those behind it of being backed by extremists and of harboring a breeding ground for hatred. It will be very interesting to see what comes out of this, but even in a city like Boston, this is still very controversial. By the way, the indication is that there are more than 10,000 Muslims actively participating in Islamic centers in the greater Boston area. So that's over 10,000. 3,000 of them at one time can be in the new mosque there in Boston. If you were watching the news today, you know that former investor Bernard Madoff, former chairman of NASDAQ, was sentenced to 150 years in prison today after admitting to running one of the largest and most costly financial frauds in human history. Judge Denny Chin in Manhattan said in issuing this 150-year maximum sentence, here the message must be sent that Mr. Madoff's crimes were extraordinarily evil. Interesting word, isn't it? Even in this morally disarmed age, it seems that you can still use the word evil for someone who bilks people out of their money. Even as we deny that the word can be used elsewhere where we know it must be used, when it comes to money, evidently most Americans still believe, in the possibility at least, of evil. We'll be back to talk about adultery on the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. I have been so fascinated, not by the immediate news concerning South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford and his adultery, nor the other recent scandals, including everyone from a senator in Nevada to you name it. It's all over the place. Going all the way back to New York Governor Eliot Spitzer just a few months ago, seems like there has been rather nonstop, but you really can't go back just there, can you? I mean, we're working our way all the way back to biblical times on the issue of adultery, and kind of an unbroken chain of broken promises, marital promises, covenant promises, fidelity promises. Adultery is so much a part of the human experience and our brokenness that when Moses came down from the mountain carrying these 10 words, the encapsulation of the law, the 10 commandments, thou shalt not commit adultery, was one of those specifically handed down by God to his people as a mark of why a covenant people would stand out as morally and spiritually distinctive from the other peoples around them. Adultery is one of the most costly sins. It is one of the most heinous repudiations of a sacred covenant. It has theological ramifications we're going to talk about in just a moment, but just at the personal level, it is one of the most significant ways one human being can betray another. It brings brokenness into a marriage. It brings brokenness into a family. Just looking again at South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, you're looking at a wife who now is known to millions of Americans simply for the fact that she is the victim of an adulterous husband. And you now know of four boys, but the youngest is 10, the oldest are teenagers, whose lives are now completely different. Just a week or so ago, they were the sons of South Carolina's governor. Now they are the sons of an adulterer. And their moral character is now the number one issue cited by their mother for her response to her husband's infidelity. The cost of adultery is just so incredibly high. Just ask King David. Just ask those who have been unmasked in their adultery. You know, the weird thing is that there is almost no one I know in the course of human history who says, I really enjoyed my adulterous experience and I commend it to others. Virtually everyone who is outed as an adulterer, everyone who is caught, and they are caught, almost every one of them says, I deeply regret this. I regret the pain that it has brought into my family. I regret the entire experience. So why do so many fall? Now, the New York Times is out with a very interesting article. I want to point to two big issues of confusion. Number one, if you've been listening to the news media and the Sunday talk shows yesterday, here was one of the questions that came up again and again and has ever since the revelation in Columbia, South Carolina. And that is this going to destroy this man's political career? Is adultery now a big deal in terms of politics, or is it survivable? That seems to be an ongoing question. That's not the main issue of my concern. My concern is more focused on what I saw in yesterday's New York Times. Here's the article. Marriage stands up for itself. The headline underneath the lead is, a scandalous affair can be a bump on the road. Here is what Benedict Carey and Tara Parker Pope write. They write, despite strong social riptides working against it, the liberalization of divorce laws, the vanishing stigma of divorce, the continual online temptations, The marriage bond is far stronger in 21st century America than many assume. Infidelity is one of the most common reasons cited by people who divorce, but surveys find the majority of people who discover a cheating spouse remain married to that person for years afterwards. Now listen to this next line. Many millions more shrug off or work through strong suspicions or evidence of infidelity, and recent trends in marriage suggest that the institution itself has become more resilient in recent years, not less so. Now, you know, the argument in this article is almost that adultery is good for marriage because learning how to deal with adultery has strengthened the institution. I find that an insidious argument. It's the kind of argument that comes where people say, I grew through my divorce. I needed this divorce in order to grow through it. My children learned how to be more resilient through the divorce of parents. These are really sad arguments, but I think this is an indication of where we are. I think that this kind of article in the New York Times is telling us that many people in America are now uncertain as to whether adultery is really a big deal. What do you think? Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Literally, the New York Times says that an affair can merely be a bump in the road of marriage. Let's talk and think like Christians. The number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Darlene, listening on WTLN in Orlando, Florida. Go ahead, Darlene.
I think you already kind of just addressed my question somewhat, because my question was, is it a big deal when politicians commit adultery, or does it really not matter at all? I know a lot of people I know tell me it doesn't matter at all. And
so you're hearing that from
question?
Some of your own friends, Darlene? You're hearing from some of your own friends that they think it's no big deal?
Not really that big of a deal.
Wow.
Politically, it's not that big of a deal. It shouldn't matter to any of us.
It's a private affair, huh?
And I wanted to know, in the church, besides the political part, what is your thoughts, like, in the church? Does adultery, in your opinion, only affect that direct family, or should it really concern us in the church when someone, our fellow friends or brothers and sisters in Christ, are committing adultery? Is it... Shouldn't we be concerned about that or not?
You bet, Darlene. What a great question. And that question isn't just a church question. It's a gospel question. I want to tell you why. It's because marriage is a picture of Christ's love for his church, as given in the New Testament. And the marriage vow is itself shown to be a parallel with the promises that God gives to us in Christ. Therefore, for a Christian couple to experience adultery, and that's too passive, for a Christian to commit adultery is to deny the very gospel whereby he has been saved. I'm not saying that he's no longer saved. I am saying that he is a believer, or she is a believer, in deep spiritual peril who desperately needs the correction of the people of God. Darlene, your question betrays something, and it's the way so many people in our churches think, and I'm thankful that you don't think that way. And that is that if we go to someone who's committing adultery, we are basically going to them and we're shutting down a party that is none of our business. Here is what we're doing. In the church, we are rescuing those who are putting their souls at peril, who are bringing evil and destruction into their lives, who are desecrating the gospel. Paul makes that clear in 1 Corinthians. They are desecrating the gospel. They are undercutting our witness to the gospel by their sin. And thus, it is actually not only our right as believers, it is our responsibility as believers. And churches that do not practice church discipline in such a sense that they would bring adultery to the attention of an adulterer, that is to me one of the saddest signs of a completely evacuated church and evacuated gospel, a church that is evacuated of serious biblical and gospel content. Darlene, you're exactly right. Now, let me point back to something else. When a couple gets married, it's very important that they exchange vows. And in the Christian tradition, for very good reason, going all the way back long before the Christian church to the people of God, the Jews, in the Old Testament, the public exchange of vows was very important because marriage is a public event. Well, the breaking of those vows is also a public event. It is not merely a private thing. And those who are involved in adultery may think that it is their little personal private secret. But it is not. And the ramifications and effects of adultery go far beyond the two persons that are there involved. It's never just two persons. By definition, adultery is at the very least a third person inserted where there should be only two. The phone number to join this discussion is 877-893-8255. Where you are, where you live, where you think, is adultery still a big deal? Give me a call at 877-893-TALK. We'll be right back.
Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, one of the things that comes up when you engage the culture is the opportunity to hear a conversation ongoing that really ought to have the attention of Christians. And this conversation in the secular world about the morality of adultery, whether especially in magnitude it's a big deal, I think that's a really important conversation. In the New York Times, one of the most important image and opinion-shaping forums in America, in that newspaper known as the Old Gray Lady because of its influence in the culture, you have a sampling of elite opinion. And in other words, if you're going to be talking to the people that write the policies, that educate the bureaucrats, if you're going to talk to the people that write the scripts of the plays and in many ways influence what goes on in college and university campuses and in the entertainment industry, this is where they look. And in this article, in the New York Times yesterday, there is a citation here by Peggy Vaughn, a San Diego-based researcher who runs the website DearPeggy.com. Listen to this. She says, quote, "People tend to assume that bad people have affairs and good people don't, or that affairs only happen in bad marriages. These assumptions are just not based in reality." And then the scare quote that is pulled out in the New York Times is this: "Wrongly assuming that bad people have affairs and good people don't." Now, I can't look at that as anything other than an effort by at least some in the elite media to say the morality of a person is not indicated by whether or not he or she commits adultery. I mean, that's the bottom line of that assertion. If you say that it's wrong to assume that bad people have affairs and good people don't, you're saying even good people have affairs. Now, in a theological perspective, the whole issue of good and bad is problematic because one of the most important things we as Christians need to say is that not one of us is morally good. We are all sinners, but that does not mean that we all commit all of these sins by the grace of God. And, you know, at the very least, in this kind of context, we should be able to agree that a good person, insofar as culturally you would even have the designation of a good person, is not one that commits adultery. There's another very interesting thing here, by the way. This particular article cites research from the University of Washington and the University of North Carolina that suggests that the greatest risk factor for infidelity, now listen to this carefully, the greatest risk factor for infidelity, and I believe this makes perfect sense, it's opportunity. Opportunity is the greatest risk factor for adultery. I want you to think about that. I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. First, I'm going to Groveland, Illinois, where Jovi is listening on WPEO. Go ahead, Jovi.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. I was just wondering if you believe that adultery is worse than other sins.
Okay, great question. And there really is no easy way to answer that is totally faithful to Scripture. So just follow with me for just a moment. First of all, every sin is an infinite insult to the glory of God. So in that sense, every sin is totally sinful. And in its essence, in a heart that is robbing God of his glory, that is disobeying God's command and breaking God's law, every breaking of the law is equally reprehensible because it's infinitely wrong in God's sight. But the Scripture says a couple of other things. First of all, Paul argues that those who commit sexual sins bring sin into the body. This is a different category of sin. Perhaps the magnitude of its sinfulness is not the right question, but the magnitude of its effect. All sins are equally and infinitely wrong, but it is not true that all sins have the same effect. You know, Jovi, if you're a mom and you've got a 5-year-old who looks you in the face and tells you a lie, the whole world comes down to that moment to understanding that this child, sweet, cute, heroic face, is a liar. And you've got to deal with that as a parent, and deal with it you must. But the effect of that sin right then at that moment is not catastrophic. That's why, God bless parents, we've got an opportunity to mold those children. But the effect of this one sin of adultery is massive. So in its heart, the magnitude of the sin, it's not different sin to sin. But the magnitude of its effect is huge. It is huge. Just think of all the concentric circles coming out of this one act of adultery in South Carolina. The fact that we're having a conversation, a national conversation about it, is one indication of the magnitude. The magnitude of the hurt drawn into this family's life, a wife and four sons, the magnitude of hurt brought into a state, the magnitude of hurt brought into, well, the entire estate of marriage. Because it is this governor's sin that became the opportunity for this newspaper to publish an article suggesting that maybe adultery isn't such a big deal after all. The magnitude of this sin is absolutely profoundly beyond our measurement huge. But in its essence, there's no different than the little child lying to his mom. Sin is sin. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. There is still time for you to call, 877-893-8255. Don't forget Twitter. You can always follow us on Twitter simply by following Albert Mohler. That's all one word, M-O-H-L-E-R, Albert Mohler. There at Twitter, we've had a couple of very interesting responses. One said, morally, it's still a big deal. Politically, perhaps not. And the very interesting point here, this young man wrote in to say, remember that my generation was weaned on Clinton's, that is, President Clinton's escapades. Interesting. So politically, here's a generation that says, maybe it's not that big a deal politically. And of course, the filter down in this, if it's not such a big deal politically, maybe it's not such a big deal morally. Someone else wrote back to say, you know, adultery made God's top 10, obviously referenced there, the Ten Commandments. I would say it's one of the most destructive sins. That gets back to the question we had earlier. In magnitude, no difference. In destructiveness or in the magnitude of its effect, big difference. In its moral weight, no difference. In the magnitude of its effect, big difference. Nolensville, Tennessee. Greg's on the line, listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Greg.
Hey, Dr. Mohler. Jesus talks about in cases of adultery where divorce is permissible, but he never talks about divorce being mandatory. If you were to counsel Mark Sanford's wife, or for that matter John and Kate Gosselin, would you advise them to divorce or to head to their church and work on their marriage?
Great question, Greg, and I can answer that succinctly, and then I'm going to come back to expand. My succinct answer is this. I never, ever counsel divorce. I would not counsel divorce where there is any possible hope for reconciliation. I think you have to hold out that hope. And I think, by the way, Mrs. Sanford has modeled that hope. I can't claim to have seen everything she said in the media or every statement that has been attributed to her, but I've seen enough to at least have some confidence that she has not foreclosed the option of Governor Sanford re-earning her trust and reestablishing the marriage. And I think at least one statement I've seen this morning about this, she makes the argument for one very good reason, and I'm going to argue there's an even better reason. The very good reason she cited is her four sons. That's a very good reason. All you have to do is look at the deleterious effects, the destructive effects of divorce in the lives of children, and in particular this infidelity that would lead to a divorce, the loss of confidence in father, and all the rest. And then without going into all the taxonomy of things that could happen, let's just say it's bad. So that's a very good reason. It was a very good reason for her to say, for the sake of my sons, I want to see if we can make this marriage work. But I think there's an even greater reason, and that is that both the governor and his wife have been professing Christians. And thus, the gospel is at stake here, and I think she can give a wonderful demonstration here of what it means to love a spouse even in the midst of adultery, and to seek the spouse's restoration, much like Hosea in the Old Testament. In this case, it was a husband who was watching the infidelity of his wife, which was a picture of the infidelity of the nation Israel against the covenant of God. But in this case, it is a wife who has shown the grace to extend the opportunity for forgiveness and for restoration to her husband. It is his responsibility to do the right thing now. And I think one of the most troubling aspects of this is that it isn't at all clear to me that this is completely over in his mind, or that he is glad it's over. And again, I can't claim to have seen everything that has been said. My main substance from which I'm drawing on this for information is that rambling press conference that the governor held, in which I think he left more questions unanswered than he answered. Greg, I would say one other big thing to the governor's wife, and that is, do not try to go this alone. This is why Christians are not called to be lone rangers, but are called to be within the fellowship of a gospel church. Go to the elders of the church. Throw yourself upon the pastoral responsibility of the elders of the church and say what must be true for every Christian: this is too big for me. I am not certain that I can come close to figuring out a tenth of this. I want to be a faithful Christian in the midst of this. Help me, guide me, advise me, assist me, teach me to really show the grace and mercy of Christ and the truth of God's word in the midst of this horrible situation. That would be my most urgent advice. It would be, don't turn to press agents. You know, don't turn to a public relations firm. Don't turn to an attorney first and foremost. Go to the church. Throw yourself upon the pastoral responsibility of the church, and then expect, and I certainly hope she has reason to expect, this church to be faithful to its gospel responsibility. And that responsibility is to her husband, and to her, and to the family, and it is a gospel ministry. Not just a pastoral ministry of comfort and reconciliation, it is a gospel ministry, because the gospel is at stake. Thanks for your question, Greg. I want to come back to the number one reason given for adultery, as indicated in this New York Times article and the research it cited, and that was opportunity. I believe that's true. It's about the only part of that article that I find myself agreeing with. I think it is clear that opportunity is a big issue. I'm going to tell you how much I believe that. I believe that so much that what we teach the students at this seminary is that you must never allow yourself the opportunity, not once, ever. And that means some pretty strict rules. And I promise you this, and there are people who think these rules are too strict. Let me tell you what the rules are. Number one, never, ever be alone with a person of the opposite sex. Never, ever. And there are people who listen to me say that. My wife, who holds to these very same rules and teaches them to ministers' wives, has gotten all kinds of kickback. I do too, from people who say that's unrealistic. It's just too strict. Well, let me tell you, here is the bottom line. If you are never alone with a person of the opposite sex, I can almost guarantee you, you're not going to commit adultery. And I do believe with all my heart and with all my mind that that is the biggest issue. You must never allow yourself the opportunity. It is the Christian's responsibility to deny herself, to deny himself, the opportunity for sin. Because as the scripture says, sin will seize the opportunity. So you need structures of accountability. You need policies by which you live. You need principles that guide your daily decisions so that you do not find yourself developing a relationship with a colleague, with a church member, with a friend, with a neighbor, with anyone with whom you do not have the right to that relationship. And married men, you do not have the right to any kind of ongoing, intense friendship with any woman other than your wife, period. You say that's pretty strict? Well, that is what marriage is understood to entail from the very beginning. One of the issues of confusion we face right now is there are persons who think that they deserve the opportunity for sin. Folks, if you think you deserve the opportunity for sin, pretty soon you're going to think you deserve the reality of that sin. That's a real quick slide. We'll be right back. Welcome. Thanks to all who called and to the many others who wrote in by Facebook and Twitter and good old email that seems downright old-fashioned these days with everything else going on around us. A couple of interesting questions that came in, and we'll be tracking some of these for future programming. Here's one that came in and said, can I, as a wife, really make expectations about my husband's workplace? But because there are immodestly dressed women and all the rest, my guess is there are thousands of wives out there that are thinking the very same thing. You know, the response to that from me has to be, I have no idea how much some men can control their workplace in terms of the dress of women and others and opportunities for lust and other things that inevitably are likely to come from that. But I would say this, you don't have to work there. And there are all kinds of opportunities where sometimes a man has to say, I have to move entirely out of this environment because this environment is for me an opportunity for sin. And the responsibility is on the man in this situation. And that's true. And, you know, I don't even know what kind of workplace this is, but my guess is it could range in everything from, you know, a school to a hospital to a factory to, you know, a sales force. And, by the way, in a lot of these offices, in a lot of these opportunities for, you know, out-of-town trips and all the rest, it's just a quantum opportunity for adultery. We give ourselves the opportunity. Pretty soon we give ourselves the reality. That's a quick rationalization in a slide from the potential to the real. And the Bible makes very clear that is a very short slide. Fascinating headline I saw in yesterday's edition of the local newspaper here, the Courier-Journal. The headline is, Louisville woman sad, comma, puzzled at son. I have to tell you, I looked at that. It's a criminal news account about something that took place where the mother is speaking of her son. But to see a headline in the newspaper that says Louisville woman sad and puzzled at son, my guess is that that's true for almost every mother of a son in the city. My guess is that there is out there some young mother with a five-year-old in timeout that is sad and puzzled at her son. My guess is most moms have been puzzled and made sad at their sons at some point. It just shows you sometimes the headlines can be written in a way that is fundamentally unhelpful. Speaking of the headlines, here's one that tells you a sign of the times. Kodak to take Kodachrome away. Eastman Kodak says Monday that because of plunging sales, it is ending production of its color film, first introduced in 1935. There, dear friends, is evidence of the digital revolution all around us. Kodak, no longer to make Kodachrome. There it goes, folks. Another American institution goes the way of now technological irrelevance. The beat goes on. I'll meet you tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.